The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained, now with a new and improved website. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com. We thank Audible for supporting the Paranormal Podcast, and for your own free audiobook with a 30-day free trial, go to audible.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible!
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harrell, and so glad to be with you once again. I think we're going to have a fun show today. First up, we're going to talk to Donald Zagudis about his new book and talk about Carl Sagan and how there may have been much more behind this very, very popular and famous science. There may have been conspiracy. And in part two, we're going to talk to a fellow podcaster, Mark Norman, about the topic of folklore. I hope you're having a happy and healthy holiday season, and I hope that you will enjoy this edition of the Paranormal Podcast. Well, this is going to be an extremely interesting show because we're going to go deep down the rabbit hole here in terms of conspiracy, and it involves someone most of you will remember as the people's scientist, Carl Sagan. Today, we're talking to Donald Zagudis. He is the author of the brand new book, The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's Untold Plot to Suppress the People's Scientists' Theory of Ancient Aliens. And what a theory it is, and it'll be very interesting to talk to Donald about it. He is a graduate of Corbin University. He has 40 years of experience investigating and analyzing the life and work of Carl Sagan as a leading skeptic and ETI theorist. Donald resides in Bend, Oregon. Donald, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be with you.
So let's talk about Carl Sagan a little bit. My remembrance, and Sagan was prominent as I was growing up. Of course, he had that famous book, Cosmos, then the PBS series Cosmos, which they recently just tried to remake. I don't think it was anywhere near as successful as the original. I remember seeing Carl Sagan come on the Johnny Carson show. I'm kind of showing my age there. So he was kind of like probably the most popular scientist in America, and my recollection is he was always very kind of dismissive of claims of things like ancient aliens and UFO experiences and so forth. Am I remembering correctly? Wasn't that kind of his public persona?
Yes, absolutely. And this is like two sides of Carl Sagan. He did fight against popular ancient alienism. He had all kinds of issues with Eric von Däniken and others. And yet, at the same time, he never disagreed with the premise. He only disagreed with the process, with how they were adjudicating the claims of ancient alienism. All the way through, from 1956 until he passed away, he was a firm believer in ancient aliens. But publicly, he came across as anti-ancient alienism because he disagreed with the process that Eric von Däniken started back in 1968 when he wrote Chariot of the Gods.
Now, in terms of Sagan, tell us a little bit about his background and how he became America's most popular scientist.
Sure. Well, he grew up in New York, and he in a Jewish family in Brooklyn. And he, right from early on, his mother drove him, you know, to get the best education possible. She saw that he was kind of a budding genius. And when he was still a teenager, he got a scholarship to go pretty much anywhere he wanted to, and he selected the University of Chicago, one of the preeminent universities in the world. And there he got his undergraduate degree, and then he got another degree at Harvard. And it's interesting, he was the world's first astrobiologist. He got degrees in both astronomy and biology. So early on, he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to be the first person to make the greatest discovery in human history, to find irrefutable proof of extraterrestrial life. And of course, the people around him all were thinking that extraterrestrial life would be found out there in outer space. And after looking all around in different options, he felt the best option that to find this kind of proof was right here on Earth. He agreed with Enrico Fermi, who said if there are extraterrestrials anywhere in our galaxy, they would have already been to Earth. So where are they? And Carl Sagan thought, well, they're not here now, but they were here in antiquity, and then they left. And somewhere there should be smoking gun evidence of that fact.
Now, did he kind of mute these ideas in his public persona? I mean, was it kind of like, I'm going to show the public kind of my skeptical side, but in the background, I'm going to pursue and think about these questions and look at the kind of believer side, so to speak?
That was not his choice. He was forced, and that's part of the conspiracy. He was forced to keep this mute in order to keep his job with NASA and to keep working in astronomy. He wanted to do to explore the planets of the solar system, and they kept him involved. He became the face and voice of NASA. He became their public image. And yet, underneath, he firmly believed that NASA or that SETI would never find intercept a radio communication from extraterrestrials. He thought the possibilities were almost nil. He thought it was a far better option to explore right here on Earth evidence of extraterrestrial life. But he didn't have a choice. In fact, in his paper that I'm going to be talking about, he said that only through extensive discussion and experiment. And the paper is about ancient alienism. It's the Bible of ancient alienism that nobody knows about. I have it reprinted in its totality in my book. And everybody that believes in ancient alienism should have a copy of this paper. For example, if I wanted to go to my kids' science class and I said, I want to talk about extraterrestrials, they'd probably say, sure, come on ahead. But if I went to the same school and I said, I want to talk about ancient aliens, they'd say, get lost. So, you know, why is it that ancient alienism is considered fringe or alternative or even pseudoscience, and extraterrestrialism, as long as they're out there in outer space, is perfectly okay?
Now, what is the best evidence that Sagan held these kind of ideas? You know, what kind of things, maybe their interviews and you talk about papers and so forth, what is the best evidence, do you feel, that there was this whole other side to Sagan?
Well, the paper that I'm talking about, the Stanford paper in 1962, he won a grant from NASA to write a paper on the possibility of extraterrestrials being here on Earth, either now or in the past. And NASA was expecting a paper to come back that said extraterrestrials are not here now and they've never been here in the past. Okay, this was back in the early Roswell days when there was a lot of interest in UFOs and all this kind of stuff. And so what they got after a year was an academic paper, and he did it in the Department of Genetics under a Nobel Prize winner, Joshua Lederberg. The paper they got back that was peer-reviewed and it was published in a scientific journal basically is an apologetic for ancient alienism. And I think NASA was totally taken off guard because it's not what they wanted. Here, the paper basically said, we don't need astronomers and we don't need physicists. We need anthropologists. We need historians. We need people that study ancient manuscripts, linguists, people that are into the earth sciences, not the space sciences. That is not what NASA wanted to hear. But to answer your question more specifically, he zeroed in on the Sumerian culture. As far as we know, the Sumerians had the earliest high civilization, and it goes back roughly 10,000 years. And what's so remarkable about the Sumerians is that it was like they hit the ground running. They were the first ones to have writing. They had mathematics. They had the rule of law. They had advanced agriculture, on and on and on. They didn't get it from anybody before them because they were the first ones. And then the civilizations that came after them, the Akkadians, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, and so on, basically what they got was from the Sumerians. So this was the evidence, or this was the lead that Sagan zeroed in on, was the Sumerians.
Now, in terms of NASA, now, if they knew that he had this kind of, not bias, but this kind of belief or this kind of thought that this could be possible, why did they let him get as big as he got if they were going to cover him up?
That's a great question, Jim. And the answer is they didn't know. Back in 1960, they had the Green Banks Conference, the famous Green Banks Conference. It was called by Frank Drake, and they had about the 11 people around the world that they felt were most expert in extraterrestrial intelligence, and Carl Sagan was one of them. And they talked about the radio telescope search, and everybody there assumed that Carl Sagan was on board with radio telescopes. They did not know about his belief in ancient aliens, or he never would have been invited to that conference. And so this was a total surprise. When this paper came out, it shocked NASA, it shocked everybody, and it really put Sagan in the doghouse, really throughout his entire career. And it was one of the reasons why he was not voted into the National Academy of Sciences. He was twice nominated and twice rejected, even though his curriculum vitae was probably three times as long as most of the other ones that were in there. And so, you know, the fact is that it came as a real surprise. Sagan kept this to himself, and then he popped it out, you know, on NASA through this paper that he wrote with a NASA grant, of all things.
Now, as he became bigger and bigger, you know, doing Cosmos, doing the books, doing the Johnny Carson program, The Tonight Show, did NASA continue to keep close tabs on him?
Absolutely. Early on, even before 1960, Carl Sagan had a top secret clearance. He worked for the RAND Corporation, working with the Pentagon on top secret military projects. And after he came out with this paper, and it was basically suppressed and squashed, it was not disseminated as it should have been, he turned in his credentials, he gave up his top secret clearances, he became an anti-war activist, he was against the Vietnam War, he became kind of a peacenik, and he was, pro-environment and all these kind of things. And so back then, it was also the days of McCarthyism, and so Carl Sagan was a man who was followed, he was tracked. I'm sure his phones were monitored, his writings were monitored. They did not want him doing anything that would had anything to do with ancient aliens. And they really didn't trust him at all, and he didn't trust them. And so he was a prolific writer. He was a charming man. He was a brilliant man. And he became very popular as the face and voice of NASA. But he was on a short leash, and he knew it, and he had to just, you know, basically abide by the rules that, you know, in order to keep on with his career.
Now, do you feel that over the years Sagan collected more evidence for his thoughts on ancient aliens? I mean, you talk about that paper at Stanford. Mentally, did he keep generating steam for this theory, and was he working on it on the side the whole time?
He was working on it on the side the whole time. In fact, the last paper he was working on before he died, the name of it is On the Rarity of Non-Spacefaring Galactic Civilizations, On the Rarity of Long-Lived Non-Spacefaring Galactic Civilizations. And I got to tell you, Jim, there are clues in his writing. He was an unusual writer. He had an unusual style. And there are clues in his writings about where his research, ancient alien research, was heading. And when I first contacted my agent about this book, I gave her a lot of my research. And she said, Don, you have too much research. You got to tone it down. Just focus on one thing. And so I did. And that's the book that we have here. But I have a whole lot of other research about what Carl Sagan found. Very, very exciting research that'll be coming out hopefully in 2018. It'll be my second book about how close Carl Sagan got to finding the smoking gun. In fact, I think he actually may have found the smoking gun, but he died under mysterious circumstances before he was able to publish his final work.
We'll talk about that more right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, and we're ever so grateful. They have such a great service. They have an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original shows, news, comedy, and so much more. You know, I love audio. I love podcasts, but I really love audiobooks. It takes it to a different level. It's a different kind of listening, but a kind of listening that I absolutely love. Audiobooks are great to listen to when you're driving or commuting. Maybe you're riding on public transportation. Maybe you're working out at the gym, doing chores around the house. They're great because you can feed your mind while you're doing whatever it is that you're doing, whether you like that other thing or not. You know, it can really make some of those things that you really loathe actually quite enjoyable, and you can have those driveway moments. For our audience, Audible is offering a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. Just go to audible.com/paranormal, that's audible.com/paranormal, and browse their unmatched selection of audio content and download a title free and start listening. It's just that easy. One audiobook you may consider, in fact, it's on the New York Times bestseller list for audiobooks right now, is The Sleeping Beauty Killer by Mary Higgins Clark. I love Audible. You'll love Audible. Try it. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial at audible.com/paranormal. That's audible.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. The subject is the new book, The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's Untold Plot to Suppress the People's Scientists' Theory of Ancient Aliens. And our guest is Donald L. Zagudis. He is the author of said book. And we're talking about Carl Sagan, his belief in the existence of ancient aliens and the behind-the-scenes background and work that he did in that regard. Now, I know that the people who were close to Sagan, I'm assuming, are aware of this book, I'm guessing. What has been the reaction? I know that as we speak in kind of mid-October here, it's not out on the shelves, but it will be by the time this is released. But what has been the reaction, the initial reaction that you've heard?
I think, Jim, that by the time this is over and done, I'm going to have everybody mad at me, not only mainstream scientists associated with NASA and the SETI Institute, but even ancient alien theorists who maybe feel a certain ownership of the genre and maybe are not quite ready to relinquish it to mainstream science. I believe ancient alienism is ready to go mainstream science, okay? And I believe the Sagan paper is the foundational document to make that happen. And also the work that Sagan did throughout his lifetime that is just coming to light. I think it's time to go for the jugular. It's time for ancient alien theorists to say, we've been at this for 50 years, and we've been developing leads, and we've been developing narratives that involve ancient aliens, but we haven't gotten any farther in actually getting the smoking gun. Let's go for the smoking gun. I believe it's right there. I'll make a prediction on your show right now. It's the first time I've done this, but I believe within 5 years we'll have the smoking gun evidence, and it'll be related to Carl Sagan and his views on ancient alienism.
We talk about the scientists and maybe how they have it wrong. How do you think maybe you said that the ancient alien kind of proponents might be angry with you as well? Where do you think that those of us who are on the more pro side or we believe that there's something to this have it wrong? Where are we maybe looking at things kind of askew?
I thought a lot about this, and I could be wrong, because I come from the mainstream science side. Over the years, I've done all my reading with mainstream science. Over there in the department of Barnes & Noble, where you have the ancient alien books, I never go over there. And so I'm just kind of learning what this community is all about. And I feel a certain kinship with these folks, because they're good people. They look at it very logically. They say, hey, if there are extraterrestrials, they're far more advanced than we are. They are godlike. There's no way in hell that they would not have made it to Earth. And we see plenty of evidence around that they have been to Earth. At the same time, Carl Sagan had a rule. It's actually called the Sagan Rule, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so you have the ancient alien community and their leaders doing all this wonderful collection of leads and narratives, but is it moving us any closer to finding the smoking gun? And that's where Carl Sagan had a problem with, say, Eric von Daniken and others, and that's where I have a problem. But at the same time, I think, okay, after 50 years, are we ready as a community of ancient alien believers, are we ready to shift over to the mainstream side of the ledger? I'm hoping that I'm wrong in saying that I'm not so sure the ancient alien community is. But if they are, then that's fantastic, because this is the material that they need to get there.
one of the old saws of the skeptics, which I've never understood, and I'll tell you why I've never understood, this whole idea that, well, you know, it's impossible that ancient aliens visited the Earth because the distances involved are too great. Well, I mean, the distances involved at going across the Atlantic Ocean were too great, you know, in 1800 in terms of flight. Man could not fly. But then, you know, here come the Wright brothers and in a couple of decades, a certain Mr. Lindbergh, and the distances weren't so great. So to me, this idea, well, it can't happen because the distances are too great, it makes no sense, because we're basing that on the assumption of our technology and our ability to transport ourselves. Obviously, if there were ancient aliens, they would have to be, by definition, more technologically advanced than we are now. So that kind of, to me, it just on the face of it makes no sense. What do you think about this old saw that, well, ancient aliens couldn't have visited because the distances involved are too far?
You raised a fantastic point, and that is interstellar spaceflight. The name of the paper, the Stanford paper, is Direct Contact Among Galactic Civilizations by Relativistic Interstellar Spaceflight. NASA, after this paper was published in a scientific journal, NASA had to come up with a reason to reject it. And so they came up with the idea that interstellar spaceflight is forever and always impossible, both for humans and for aliens, for anybody. Even though Wernher von Braun back in those days was already speculating about going to the stars. But nevertheless, that was a cornerstone doctrine of NASA, and it stayed a cornerstone doctrine until Carl Sagan died. And then shortly thereafter, NASA begins work on building interstellar starships by the end of the century. They've got two programs, and I would encourage your listeners to go check these out on the internet because they're fantastic. One is Icarus Interstellar, and the other one is the 100-Year Starship Project. And there you can find advanced concepts, scientific papers on how to go about building an interstellar spacecraft. And yet for 30 years, as long as Carl Sagan was alive, they said that interstellar spaceflight was absolutely impossible. And this goes back to the conspiracy thing again, because as soon as Carl Sagan was dead, they immediately started looking at building a starship by the end of the century.
Very, very interesting. So another point that you bring up, and I'm curious about this, how, and I've often asked this in general about the idea of alien visitation, if there were disclosure, how would religions act and how would they respond? How would they respond to proof of ancient aliens?
Well, Carl Sagan is on record, and I have this in my book, of saying that he was absolutely convinced that Jesus Christ was an extraterrestrial. Okay. The question you ask is a profound, earth-shaking question, because if ancient alienism is proven to be a scientific fact, then we have to revisit virtually every philosophical and religious question that is out there right now. If ancient aliens introduced civilization to humans, and shortly after civilization there came religion with their gods, why couldn't those gods have been godlike extraterrestrials rather than deities? And so I think that if this takes root, if this evidence takes root, if my book gets a fair hearing, I think that theologians, particularly Christian and Jewish theologians, are going to be pretty upset. I think that they're, and I hope they are, and I hope they engage the subject rather than try to ignore it or walk away from it. Because if you look at what Jesus Christ said, I am not of this world, you can go right on through the New Testament and see all kinds of passages that would be very applicable to an extraterrestrial.
Another thing that's interesting is this idea of the relationship between NASA and the Pentagon, because we know that the government, and these are things that we know that they shoot stuff in, up on rockets, and there's experimental craft and things that are admitted, but we're never told why. And you've got to believe that some of this is of a military nature and national security nature. And to me, it seems natural that there have to be some secrets. Obviously, in terms of national security, you can't spill the beans on everything. That makes sense. But is there kind of an unholy alliance between NASA and the Pentagon?
Of course there is. And I understand, did you interview Annie Jacobson?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
The Pentagon's Brain, I would encourage everybody to read it. It's a fantastic book, and she talks about the inner workings of the Pentagon, the secret workings, especially DARPA, and then an even more secret agency called JASON. And these agencies work at over-the-horizon military concepts that are just, you know, top secret. Well, the truth is that the SETI Institute is an appendage of NASA, and NASA is an appendage of the Pentagon. And the SETI Institute could not function without grants and financial largesse of NASA, and NASA could not function without the largesse of the Pentagon. And the relationship between NASA and the Pentagon is something that's not talked about enough, not investigated enough. There's a lot of great scientists at NASA who want nothing to do with war machines and all that stuff, the secret military. They just want to do their science. They want to do the science that they love to do, and that's what they were trained to do. But the fact is, and they know this, and it has to tear at their hearts, is that everything that they do has to have at some point some military application. Otherwise, they will not get the money to go ahead with the science. So whether it be the trip to the moon, whether it be the trip to Mars or exploring the other planets, all this technology that NASA is developing behind the scenes has military application. And this is another reason why Carl Sagan's Ancient Alien paper was rejected. It didn't have any military application, whereas Frank Drake and the radio telescope project did. They could use radio telescopes to spy on what Russia was doing and so on. But with Sagan's plan, an Earth-based plan, they had no military applications, so the Pentagon had no interest in it.
And I should say, we have not interviewed Annie on her latest book. We need to rectify that. But on Operation Paperclip and also on Area 51, she's always fascinating, very interesting.
Get her on the Pentagon's Brain. It's a fantastic book, and it's really, really revealing. And I use it quite a bit for documentation in my book.
Now, okay, well, you mentioned this earlier, and I didn't pick up on it, but we can't just leave this hanging here. You seem to think that Sagan's work in this regard had something to do with his death. Now, he died a relatively young man, 62 years of age. In fact, I was just looking that up while we were talking, and I couldn't believe it was only 62 years old. You kind of forget these things because he passed almost 20 years ago now. Tell us about that, because that's a pretty heavy accusation there.
Yeah, I make a case in my book, and I say right off the bat that I don't have conclusive evidence. But there's a set of circumstances that it's very hard to ignore. He died of an extremely rare disease, and I hope I'm saying this right, called myelodysplasia. It's a form of cancer. And one of the things that can cause this rare form of cancer is exposure to radioactivity. Now, my theory, and it's only a theory, I want to stress that, is that Carl Sagan, and he was healthy, he was vigorous, he was lean, his favorite sport was basketball. He had his one health situation was he had difficulty swallowing food. Sometimes he'd get up from the table and jump up and down so he could swallow his food. But other than that, he maintained a work schedule that very few people could keep up with. And all of a sudden, he got hit with this terrible, terrible disease. My theory is that Carl Sagan was standing in the way of the Pentagon's and NASA's plan to build an interstellar starship, because anti-interstellar spaceflight was the reason for rejecting his paper. And if NASA would have suddenly come out and said, hey, we're going to build or going to start working on a interstellar starship, Carl Sagan would say, well, okay, so if humans are ready to build a starship, shouldn't extraterrestrials, probably millions of years more advanced than us, have built them that long ago, and shouldn't they have already been to Earth? In other words, if you eliminate the interstellar problem, then that makes Sagan's paper absolutely viable. You've taken away the one objection that NASA used for rejecting it, and that is they're saying that interstellar spaceflight is impossible. So, again, there's a set of circumstances there that I don't know if it'll ever be investigated or looked into, but I put it in my book. I do have questions why this happened, the timing of it, and shortly after Sagan died, NASA starts two programs working on interstellar spaceflight concept. So, you know, you can take it for what it's worth.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. I mean, this idea that someone who was, I think among even believers, I think he was well thought of in general, even if we might have said, you know, he's being a little rough on some people. I think he was well thought of and people liked him. I think he came across as a media personality, as a likable person. And my reaction was, what a smart guy. I'll never be that intelligent. Now, when you look at his successors in terms of skeptics, one thinks of a person who's been a guest on this show, Dr. Michael Shermer, who actually was very much a gentleman on coming on the show. And it's interesting, and I bring him up a lot. So I'm going to say a couple things that people have probably heard. But one is, you know, I told him, Dr. Shermer, you know, we may agree in the vast majority of cases, but I would put out there that there are a few percentage of, for example, UFO cases or possibly paranormal cases that we can't explain. I mean, we've looked at all reasonable methods, and the people are credible who are reporting these things and have no reason, no profit motive or anything like that. And what would you say about these few percentage points of cases? And he said, oh, we know they exist. We just put them on the shelf. And I thought, why would you put those on the shelf? You'd want to take those down and investigate them. But the other thing I would mention about him, and which fascinates me, is he in Scientific American probably a couple of years back wrote about his own paranormal experience. And of course, concluded with something like, well, the only logical explanation's paranormal, but of course it wasn't. I mean, how would someone like a Shermer react to this?
Michael Shermer is one of my favorite authors. I think I've read all of his books. I learned about the scientific method through his trilogy of The Believing Brain and Why People Believe Weird Things and so on. And I've actually had exchanges with Dr. Shermer. And I think that he has a real problem, or will have a real problem, with this book. And I mention him quite a bit in the book. And the problem that he has in what he calls cognitive dissonance, that where a person can hold two conflicting views at the same time. In his writings, he has one of the things that he calls Shermer's Last Law, where advanced aliens are so godlike that why do we need religion? That anything that the Bible has, any miracles that the Bible talks about, advanced aliens could do all those things and more. In fact, he talks about ancient aliens being able to possibly even create new universes. And yet at the same time, he believed that extraterrestrials are too far away to get to Earth. That makes absolutely no sense at all. And so I would challenge Dr. Shermer to a debate, a face-to-face debate, or however. But I think he's going to have some real issues trying to explain away the evidence in the Stanford paper. And also, by the way, Carl Sagan was Michael Shermer's hero. He dedicated one of his books to Carl Sagan. And in fact, he credits Carl Sagan with turning him from religion and to science. And yet he never, ever, in any of his writings, mentions the Stanford paper. So I just think that, he's going to have a lot to answer for when this book comes out.
Well, it's fascinating. As I said, when this is released, the book will be out. So the question is, where can people get this explosive book?
Thank you for asking. Pretty much anywhere. It's due to roll out on November the 21st. It'll be at pretty much all your favorite book outlets. Of course, it'll be on Amazon. It'll also be on audio and Kindle and Nook. You know, it'll be out there, and I believe it's going to be marketed worldwide. There's already people in Japan and France that are looking at it, and it'll be reviewed at the Frankfurt Book Festival this week. And so I think over the next year or two, I think it's going to get a lot of exposure, and I'm looking forward to a lot of reactions, both plus and minus. And by the way, Jim, I am very open. I don't have an agenda. I'm not trying to start an organization or a movement. I feel like I'm an honest truth seeker in the really the deepest sense of the word. So if anybody can, you know, when they look at this book and say Zygutis is crazy on this point or that point, I'm open to be proven wrong. I feel like it's a very strong book, a well-documented book, and I think I make my points with clarity, and I'm willing to stand by them. At the same time, I'm not saying that this is gospel. You know, I want to engage other people in intelligent discussions. And that's what I'm doing right now with you. At least I hope so.
Very good. Well, thank you, Donald Zagudis. But I must say, this is a fascinating premise. I haven't seen the book yet, but I can't wait to do so. And I think it's going to be a very, very thought-provoking read. Donald, thank you for joining us today on the program.
It's my privilege, Jim. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, that was certainly interesting. I didn't know about that, let alone even think of it. My goodness. Well, we thank Donald for joining us, but we're not done yet. Oh, no. Next up is Mark Norman. We're going to talk about folklore right after this important message on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia. This time of the year, instead of season's greetings, I guess these days I should be saying streaming greetings, because almost everyone will find a new streaming device in their stocking, whether it's a Chromecast, an Apple TV, a Roku, or if you've got a really big stocking, a smart TV. Now, all of those platforms are fantastic, but the question, the important thing is, what do you watch? Now, of course, you have all those great movie channels everyone knows about. The names are household names. I won't repeat them here. But what if you want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained? Well, there is an answer, and that answer is Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the topics we love. And not only is Gaia great on streaming devices, but Gaia has a brand new website that has taken everything they do to the next level. You can enjoy your own personalized homepage and always have great recommendations ready to stream. You watch their shows with upgraded lightning-fast streaming. You'll experience their simplified navigation for easy discovery, and you can bookmark your favorite moments and mind-blowing new ideas with Gaia's Community Hearts feature. So you can stream Gaia anywhere. All these great devices, the great website, on apps, on your devices, your phones, and your tablets. It's fantastic. Regardless of the platform, you explore life's biggest mysteries from specialists in these areas on Gaia's exclusive programs with hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and of course, George Norrie. It really is the way to go. I think that you will really enjoy Gaia, and it's a great time to join because the first month of your membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. To mind the wisdom, be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That is GAIA.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, it's only 99 cents. You probably have that rattling around in your couch cushions. Check it out. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. Well, today our guest, I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. We're going to talk about folklore with Mark Norman. He's calling in from the UK, and he is a folklore researcher, podcaster, and author based in the United Kingdom. He is a committee member of the Folklore Society, which is the longest standing learned society for study of folklore. And he's also a committee member of the Friends of the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic. In addition, he is an author with books such as Black Dog Folklore. And he is also a podcaster, a fellow podcaster. He has a podcast that's been out for several months now focusing on folklore called The Folklore Podcast. Mark Norman, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for inviting me.
So I guess a good place to start would be with like a baseline of what do you consider to be folklore? How do we define folklore?
Sure. Well, folklore in its literal definition is the lore, that is the beliefs of folk, that is people. So it is the general belief systems of people within a culture or a community, how they interpret what is around them and what they believe in. Now, the term folklore was first coined as a term in the 19th century in 1846 over here in the UK by an antiquarian called William Toms. And it was originally hyphenated folklore, so the beliefs of the people. So it's really looking at similar themes to yourself as a paranormal show in many ways, but from a slightly different approach. Now, a paranormal researcher or a paranormal investigator is going to be setting out to look at ghosts, for example, or Bigfoot, or whatever area you want to look at, and setting out to try and provide evidence to prove or disprove the existence of that phenomena. Folklore is slightly different. As a folklorist or as a folklore researcher, it doesn't matter to me whether or not these things are true. So, for example, fairies or UFOs, whether they are true or not is a debate perhaps for other guests on your show. For me, what's important is why people explain the experiences they have in these ways in the way that they do. Let me give you an example. If you consider the two that I've just said, fairies and UFOs, there are very many parallels and similarities between people who report experiences with the fairy folk within folklore and people who report being abducted by UFOs. So there are reports of losses of a passage of time. There are reports of similar flying discs in different ways, but very similar between the two. The descriptions are very similar. The traditional grey alien description, almond-shaped eyes, lithe, thin body, matches up with a lot of 19th century descriptions of fairies. There are even very small similarities. People who were abducted by fairies often reported a very earthy smell, and UFO abductees have often reported something similar, a bit like cinnamon. So what's happening is that people are having an experience of these things, but it's how they are decoding or understanding that experience that varies over time. So in the 19th century, fairy beliefs were very, very strong within many communities. So people would naturally draw on the earth and the landscape and what is around them to understand the symbolism of their experience. In more modern times, since Kenneth Arnold and the big UFO flaps, we find that is a very strong part of modern culture now, whereas fairy beliefs have tended to die away. So people are using what is around them to decode their experiences. So as a folklorist, I don't doubt that people have experiences. You know, some people will invent things because people do that. But for me, it's all grist to the mill because it all adds to building up these myths and these legends and traditions, which kind of encompass what folklore is. So it's a slightly different approach.
Now, do you study folklore across the world or do you focus on the UK?
I mostly focus on the UK. Folklore is a very, very broad subject, and you have to kind of tailor your interests in a particular way. So for me, I have two particular research interests, one of which is the folklore of the area in which I live, which is the southwest of the UK. I live on the edge of Dartmoor, which is where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle set the Hound of the Baskervilles, for example. So it's a very kind of open moor, remotish type place. It's the kind of place where legends and traditions are born in some ways. So I focus down on that. And then the main focus of what I do is the collection of this data for the study of apparitions of ghostly black dogs.
Now, that is an interesting one, the lore of the black dog. Talk to us. I mean, I want to get to the broader conversation of folklore and why it's important to humans, but this is something you've specialized in. Talk to us about the black dog.
Well, the black dog as a symbol is very, very strong within communities all around the world. It's not a British phenomenon. You find it in lots and lots of different countries. And sightings of these apparitions of ghostly black dogs have been reported for an awful long time. Now, I've collected these for some time now. I originally came about this research because I was working on an archive in a university library in the UK, which had been lodged after the death of Theo Brown, who was another folklore researcher in the 1950s. And she collected a lot of these black dog accounts. And I was working on this archive and thought, you know, there's a lot to work with here. There are unpublished manuscripts of her work. There are all these collections. So since then, I've been looking at this field. I now hold what is believed to be the UK's largest archive of these sightings and traditions and eyewitness accounts of black dogs, 1,000+, I think. I don't sit and count them. There's far too many. But the phenomenon has been recorded for around about 1,000 years now, when you go back through the records. And what's really interesting is that despite there being a huge body of recorded lore about this subject over such a long period of time, lots of people record having these experiences, but they think that it's unique to them. And this is something that might resonate with some of your listeners, possibly, where they've had an experience, they think that they've experienced something that nobody else has. So they kind of sit on it and they don't report it for a long time until they learn that other people have too. For example, in a couple of years ago, in 2014, I was written to by an American lady called Laura Christensen. She'd been living abroad a few years previously. I had a request for sightings of black dogs on the Folklore Society website at the time. And she wrote to me and she said, "Oh, I ran across your request for black dog sightings. And since the topic has been on my mind ever since learning recently that my experiences aren't unique, I thought I would record mine for you." And she then went on to tell her story. So she thought that what had happened to her was something that had not happened to anybody else. Whereas, in fact, as I say, these things had been recorded for an awfully long time. The earliest recorded sighting that I have in my archive, for example, comes from 1127.
Wow.
And it's, yeah.
A few years back,
before both you and I, Jim. Yes. And this was from a document called the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle in the UK. It was a kind of a history of the country. It ran from the very early times. It was compiled for King Alfred. And around 892 AD, it was sent out to monasteries across Britain to be copied, because that was the way that documents were moved around at that time. The monks would copy them by hand as manuscripts. And it was a kind of a history of the UK. And what happened is it went to different monasteries and it got copied by the monks there. But then the copies that were lodged in these monasteries were added to with a kind of local history element. And this went on until like 1066, mainly the Norman conquest. But there was one which went on a lot longer to the middle of the 1100s, 1150s. And in this document, which was from Peterborough in the UK, there was a translation. Although there was a passage about the black dog, and there's a common translation that you find in a lot of literature about the subject. And it says in this document, it's talking about ghostly apparitions of hunters. The wild hunt is a kind of European Germanic tradition of monstrous kind of demonic riders that ride through the sky. And they're accompanied by these black dogs. And in this document, it says, "Many men both saw and heard a great number of huntsmen hunting. The huntsmen were black, huge and hideous, and rode on black horses and on black he-goats. And their hounds were jet black, with eyes like saucers and horrible." That's the common translation of this passage. Now, that translation is actually slightly wrong, because the word saucer comes from the 14th century. So it's not a direct translation. The correct translation is that the hounds were black and big-eyed and loathsome. But the meaning holds true. It's essentially a description of what goes on to become a common description of apparitions of black dogs. So they're large animals. They have large eyes. They're often horrific looking. And this is the earliest recording. Now, in fact, there are two types of black dog apparitions which we look at, not just this kind of horrific type. That's a particular type that we find in certain areas of the world, and within the UK in particular areas. Actually, half of the sightings of black dogs that are recorded are not at all threatening. They're actually protective in a lot of cases, or they're quite neutral, or they're attached to families. And this other type, which is known as the shuk or the bar guest over here in the north of the country, is the kind of horrific, demonic style that gets all the bad press for the subject, really. It's the kind that journalists will use if they're talking about this, because it's far more exciting than talking about something that looks like an ordinary dog, essentially.
Now, you said something before when you were talking about fairies as opposed to maybe UFO sightings and some of the commonalities there. Now, I know you don't get into the business as much if something is true, but is there a possibility that cross-generationally that people are experiencing something and that we just as humans have a tendency to kind of put it through the prism of the time? You know, I mean, people don't go around these days that much talking about fairies. We talk about aliens. You know, that's kind of what we've seen in the popular media. That's the first thing, you know, people's mind go to in these situations. Whereas back then it may have been fairies. Do we kind of, I mean, could some of these things represent phenomena that is basically the same phenomenon, but is just being filtered differently and described differently and put into a particular box by two vastly different cultures separated by hundreds of years?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think that is kind of the nub of what is happening in a lot of ways. There is an approach to folklore which was put forward by many researchers, and it's a kind of Jungian philosophy. And that is that there is a folk memory, or a kind of collective consciousness that sits within all of our minds in some way. And therefore, we are drawing on this collective folk memory when we're interpreting what happens around us. And I think this is a very sound theory in many ways. The dog as a symbol is very important to us as humans. The dog was domesticated right back into prehistoric times. Evidence suggests the Mesolithic or that kind of era was the time that the dog was first being domesticated and used. And the dog is important to man at that time. So it's a hunter. It provides a voice with its bark where humans can't speak at that particular time. Bones are used for weapons or for tools. So it's a very, very important symbol. And therefore, there is an argument that this carries forward, as you say, and becomes embedded as part of our collective consciousness, and we draw on this folk memory. And what happens, yes, is that over time, descriptions shift and change, but they retain very, very similar aspects, like the fairies and the UFOs. Because what we do is we compare these things to what is happening around us. So in the 1950s and the 1960s, you find lots and lots of accounts of black dogs where the size, for example, is described as being as big as a calf or as big as a Newfoundland, a very large dog, sometimes as big as a pony. Well, at that time, lots of people lived and worked on the land. So that was very important to us. So we draw on that as a comparison. So we see something unusual. It's a symbolic experience. We decode that symbolism as human beings with what we know. And at that time, calves or ponies are important to us. Now, in more recent reports of black dog sightings, we find the same experiences, the same common themes, but the descriptions and the comparators that people use change. So now we find people saying, and this comes out of the States quite a lot, interestingly, that when they have these reports of black dogs, that the phrases they use are that it's as big as a wolf, or that it resembles a wolf in some way. Where you have the more horrific type of black dog apparition cited or reported, traditionally the eyes always used to be said to be red or fiery. In more recent ones, they're black or they're yellow in lots of ways. And also in more recent reports, there are a lot more descriptions of auditory phenomena. So people report growling and snarling and scratching of claws and these kinds of things. In the older reports from the mid-20th century, there is very, very little sound ever reported. The only thing might be the noise that the feet of the dog make as it walks, which give some types of black dog their name in some ways. So what's happening, like you say, is that we're decoding these experiences based on what's happening around us. Now, as far as this description of the wolf and the color of the eyes and so on being used rather than the calves and ponies, for example, we can look at modern entertainment, television and film. Subjects from the Victorian times to the mid part of the 20th century were a lot tamer. You had penny dreadfuls and this kind of pulp fiction in Victorian times that dealt with ghost stories and horror themes, but not in a really kind of strong way like they do now. Now you get films that American Werewolf in London springs to mind, where you're looking at lycanthropy. You get films that draw on these subjects where the horror theme is far more blatant. So therefore we draw on that a lot more now as part of our culture, which surrounds us all. Ben Radford, who's a folklore researcher, he's excellent. He's looking at the clown phenomena at the moment, which is great. And hopefully I'm going to get him onto the folklore podcast to talk about these kind of killer clown folklore that's coming up around us. But he also wrote a book called Tracking the Chupacabra. That's the Mexican goat sucker, for people that don't know. So, yes, a cryptid animal. And he suggests the same in his book, actually. He says that reports are influenced by modern movies and by what ourselves as consumers of modern entertainment have around us. We've got much more of a stomach for horror than we used to. So when we decode the symbolism of these odd experiences of black dogs that we have, we're naturally drawing on that. So, yes, we're still using this collective consciousness or folk memory, which kind of steers the experience, if you like, and we draw on that for its main themes. But then we decode those with what's around us in the modern world. And that's why these descriptions shift and change slightly, although the overall theme remains constant.
And it's interesting. I will say this about Ben. He was on the show. He's a great guest. I think he's pretty much a pretty hardcore skeptic, I think. And I think that, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but my guess is he would think that therefore these accounts may not be true. It's just my guess based on my discussions with him and things I've read by him. Whereas I might say, yes, they are colored. They are maybe put into a certain description and in a certain category because of pop culture and all these things, but doesn't mean that it didn't really happen.
That kind of makes you a kind of halfway house, Jim, between folklore and paranormality. I like that.
Yeah. I'm kind of got a, you know, what is it? Neither hot nor cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth. So I kind of fall into that. Mark Norman is our guest. He is a folklorist, and aptly enough, his podcast is called The Folklore Podcast. He's also an author, a researcher, who is into all of this stuff, and the great conversation we're having today. Now, Mark, I know you specialize in the UK. I mean, to me, that has got to be an absolute treasure trove just because of the mere age of your area of the world. Whereas in the United States, if something is 100 years old, we consider it ancient. There, we're talking about way, way, way back. It's got to be a very kind of rich landscape for you.
Yes, it absolutely is. And we do find stories, as I was saying earlier, that kind of go right back through history. The difference is that with the older accounts, they take on a more traditional or legendary aspect, I guess. Whereas more recent accounts, we can classify more as eyewitness accounts. You find the same thing with ghosts broadly, I guess. I have a show on the podcast. The second show I did looks at some different types of folk ghosts, like phantom carriages, for example. And folk ghosts are kind of a little bit more distinct from the kind of experiences that people on campfire talk to you about, for example. Because with folk ghosts, there's not necessarily, in a few cases there are, but generally, there's not necessarily an eyewitness account that says Jim Harold was walking down the street and saw this phantom coach approach him with four white horses, etc., etc. What you find is that on this particular road, in this particular area, there was a story in the 14 and 1500s that such and such a thing happened. So we've got two distinct categories, really. We've got this kind of folk motif of a haunting that's attached to a particular place, but no eyewitness account to back it up, for want of a better term. or we've got the accounts where people have genuinely experienced something, you can sit down with those people in a contemporary setting and talk to them about their experience and record it. And the two are quite distinct, because the reports that you get from eyewitness accounts can be very detailed, and you can pick them apart and you can say, yeah, you know, within the current landscape and what's around us, I can see how this would happen and that would happen, and that's absolutely fine. In the older, sort of more folk-based accounts, they change and they develop over time, and they adopt these more fantastical aspects, and that's where they start to become more legendary. You can't say that anybody experienced this particular thing. A story has developed, it's been shaped over time. For example, I wrote a piece recently about fire, about the folklore of fire for the podcast. And there's a tradition within the UK of public houses, inns, pubs, whatever, where the fire has burned for 100 years, 200 years, without ever being put out. And this is a kind of it's the same way as ghosts appear in a lot of pubs in Britain. It's because it's good for business. But these places keep their fire burning. But sometimes there's a route to these stories, when you go back and look at it, that shows how a simple story happens and then changes over time. So there's a pub in the UK, in the north of the UK, I forget exactly where it is, that has one of these fires that, or had one of these fires, it's closed now, that was reportedly never extinguished. And the reason behind it, when you go back through the stories, goes back to the time of smuggling. So smugglers would bring in illicit alcohol or other substances by boat, and they'd have to hide it from the customs and revenue men. And the landlord of this pub was sympathetic to this happening. So he would allow beer and spirits to be stored secretly in his pub. And one night the pub was raided by customs officials. They searched the pub. They didn't find anything. So they all left, apart from one who hid and tried to surprise people and catch them in the act later on. He made himself known to them. A fight broke out and the customs official got murdered, says the story. So they hid his body beneath the fireplace. The landlord said, never let this fire be put out, because nobody will ever search underneath a lit fire for a body. And that's the end of that particular story. Now, that as a story is quite plausible. That could quite easily have happened. But then you fast forward sort of 200-400 years to a few years ago, when this pub was still in business, and the story has changed and developed. So the initial root of the story is still there. The smuggling is still there. The fight is still there. And the killing of this customs officer is still there. But now the story has developed, and it has now become bad luck to put the fire out. Because if you do, the ghost of the customs man will rise from the fire and will haunt the building, and it will be bad luck to everybody there, etc., etc. They're all typical folklore themes. So an original story has taken place, but then over time it has changed and developed. And we find that a lot. So, yes, the landscape here really allows for this to happen a great deal, because some of our stories do, like this, go back hundreds and hundreds of years.
Now, to the point about these stories going back, you know, and I think folklore has probably been around as long as mankind has been verbal with the oral tradition. Why do you think folklore, whether it's true or it's not, why do you think it seems to be such an inherent part of mankind and our experience on this planet?
I guess it's really because folklore is a predominantly oral tradition when you go back through time. And you go back to from prehistory through the early period into the early modern and the medieval, before the printing press, before written records were kept. We were essentially a world of storytellers. We passed all our knowledge from one person to another using these oral techniques. So it became second nature to us to tell stories, which means that it also became second nature to us to decode these stories and to understand them by relating to our belief systems in each culture and to the world around us. As time has gone on, folklore, like everything else, has changed and developed and shifted slightly. and it kind of branches in different ways. So you have this storytelling element still. It's a very, very important part of folklore to tell stories and to use traditions to create and to shape and to communicate these stories. But now there is this element of collection and of using this collection of data of people's beliefs and traditions to better understand the cultures around us and the world in which we live, why these things are important to people, how these beliefs came about and how they shape the people that we are. And looking at your side here as a paranormal podcast, there's a lot of crossover, and it's really, really valuable material to be able to draw on to when you look at people's beliefs. I mean, a big part of ghost investigation, for example, is looking at that eyewitness testimony, yeah, and saying, why is this person or these people reporting this? And looking at the world around them and looking at the beliefs of the area that you're investigating and say, is there a tradition here that's being drawn on? Is there something that will help us to better understand this experience by going back and saying, well, has this happened before? Did this happen to people 50, 100, 200 years ago? Did something similar happen that has changed and developed over time? And it helps us both from an investigative aspect, I guess, and from my side as a folklorist to understand these experiences that people are having better.
Well, it's been a great discussion. I've really enjoyed it. And you really got all the bases covered with your work with different museums and societies and your books and your podcast. So now we've got to tell people, where can they go to connect with all this great content on the subject of folklore?
Well, there are many places to go to. So for my own content, and this is all pretty easy to remember, really, the Folklore Podcast is easy to find on the internet because it's at www.thefolklorepodcast.com. Not too tricky. There is a Facebook page for it as well, which is also The Folklore Podcast, and there's a discussion group with the same name. So that's all pretty easy to find. My book on black dog folklore is published out of the UK by Troy Books. Again, they're on the internet at troybooks.co.uk. Troy Books are an esoteric book publisher in the UK of folklore and myth and magic related books. Very high quality hardback and softback editions. So the book is available through there. I also have a page on Facebook, which is facebook.com/MarkNormanFolklore, which is my personal research into lots of other areas outside of the podcast. And people can like that page too. And also check out the Folklore Society if you're interested in this academic aspect as well. And there's a lot on their website that's worth looking at. But people can connect with me through either the podcast Facebook page or my Facebook page at Mark Norman Folklore, and just drop a message. And you know, folklore is all about talking to people about their experiences and their beliefs and learning more about the tradition. So I'm always happy to talk to people in that way.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, Mark, and I hope that everybody checks out everything that you do. Thanks again.
No problem. Thank you, Jim.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that edition of the Paranormal Podcast as much as I did. And I hope that you will spread the word this holiday season far and wide about the program. Maybe you'll be at a family get-together or a holiday party and say, hey, I know you're into the spooky. Let me show you where on your iPhone or your Android you can listen to the Jim Harold podcast, the free ones, the Paranormal Podcast, and Jim Harold's Campfire. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Come on, don't be a Scrooge. Please share the love. We thank you so much, and we love you, and we love all the things that you've done in terms of helping expand the audience. You've been great in 2016. We're hoping for even bigger things in 2017, and we sincerely thank you very much. Be careful out there. Have a good holiday season, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye, everybody.
Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold, and jimherold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to jimherold.com, and thanks for listening.